Morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Council. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Ross, Judge Chesson, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 22nd, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar this morning, and we're here on the first matter, which is A210032 Lang versus Olson. Counsel, thank you for your patience. We had a little bit of technical difficulties this morning, but we're ready to go. It looks like everybody's able to hear us and see us all right. I'm going to ask that you please mute your microphone when you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd also ask that you, Mr. Lang, I do not see your video. Mr. Hansen, there we go. Mr. Hansen, did you hear everything that we had to say earlier?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir. Counsel, I am going to ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking because this matter is being recorded. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Nathan Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N, appearing on behalf of Appellant Roger Olson. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. Today, I'm not going to use all of my 15 minutes. I have a very narrow issue, and I don't have too much to say about it. I do want to talk some about it because I have some other sort of things I'd like to discuss about it. This is a pretty straightforward matter. I was not counsel in the underlying district court matter. And what's before the court is the issue of whether or not a mediated settlement agreement that was mediated with a mediator can be enforced if it does not bear the signature or date, a date or signature of the parties.
Can I pause you there for a minute and ask you to address an issue that's preliminary to that, which is whether you get to raise that argument? When was the first time you presented it? Was that argument presented in the, you said you didn't represent your client below. Did anybody raise this specific argument in front of the district court?
No, but this is a good question because this is the way I look at that issue. And that's a very good question. This is no different to me. And I think in the way our law should be, it is applied in the state. Then for example, and I'm going to reason by analogy, like, let's say you're pleading somebody guilty to a crime and you've got to lay a factual basis and you've got to lay out all the elements and you got to waive all the rights and you've got to do that. And the district court has to independently review that for its sufficiency.
So I have a couple of problems with the argument. You can help me through it. First of all, did you provide a reply brief?
No.
So this is the first time anybody's hearing this argument. So I'm wondering whether you haven't forfeited your argument responding to the forfeiture argument, but also would you cite to us the case law that stands for the proposition that this connection that you've made between the criminal procedure and the civil procedure as regards to a mediated settlement agreement? Give me the case that cites those two.
Well, there is no case on that, but I'd like to continue on with my analogy because I have more.
Well, before you do that, explain why we should consider it since you didn't address the argument in a brief. Usually what happens is if you don't raise an argument in the district court, you lose it. If you don't raise it in the court of appeals, you lose it. If you don't respond to an argument in the court of appeals that's been briefed, you lose it. That's usually the way it works.
Many years ago, I want to address this issue about raising this issue. This is something that is, you cannot just go into the court and abrogate Minnesota statutes. The statutes have to be applied. So if like residential tenants, they have certain rights.
Hold on, pause a minute. Why do you get to make this argument on appeal since you didn't brief it, either in your opening brief or your reply brief?
Brief what argument?
The response So it's front and center in the response brief that you forfeited this argument. And the first time I'm hearing you reply to that argument that you forfeited the argument by not raising it in the district court is now during oral argument. So I'm wondering why it is usually you don't get to argue beyond your brief.
How did I forfeit an argument that I raised in my appellant in the brief, in my opening brief? This is the argument that I made in my opening brief. How would I forfeit the argument that I made in my opening brief?
Maybe I wasn't clear. The respondent has said that you forfeited this argument. And then I was waiting for your reply brief to hear you respond to his argument about forfeiture.
That I forfeited it at the district court, or I forfeited it at the Court of Appeals?
Well, both, but why don't we begin with the latter?
At the Court of Appeals, it's in my brief. I'm making the argument in my brief.
Rather than me taking up your time, I don't think you're hearing what my question is. So why don't you just go ahead with your argument?
I'll do that. Thank you. This is no different than if there's, for example, many years ago, I had a case where I was on the other side and somebody brought a motion for summary judgment and nobody responded. And then they said, well, you know, you didn't respond to our summary judgment motion, so you lose. Well, when the court is looking at summary judgment, the court needs to independently look at the record of the case. And that's the same here. When something comes before the court needs to look at what the applicable law is. Here, the law is clear. There's a statute on point. If you have a mediated settlement agreement, you need to have a signature under the statute 57233 subdivision 4. You need to have a signature and a date of the parties for the mediated settlement agreement.
Mr. Hansen, if I can stop you there, assuming we do reach this issue, isn't it a matter of statutory interpretation what constitutes a signature? I mean, isn't that a question for us to review with that lens?
Well, there's no signature of my client anywhere here. The respondent cites a statute that says that an attorney can bind. They cite statute 48108, saying an attorney can bind a client. But that says that needs to be in the presence of the court administrator or an open court. We don't have that here. There was no binding.
So one way I would think about looking at this, and I just want to get your response to this, would say, okay, this is an issue of statutory interpretation. What counts as a signature? And that we would look to contract law because the other provisions of this act say, well, if you're looking at the effect of a mediated settlement agreement, look to terms of contract law. And so if we look at contract law, we have some cases out there that say, look, typewritten signatures can count as a signature. Why wouldn't that be a fair way for us to interpret whether this there was a signature to this settlement agreement?
There is no signature of my client, typewritten or otherwise, anywhere in the record in this matter. Nowhere. So that we don't even need to get to that question because it belies the record.
But then doesn't that get us to what counts as the signature of the attorney representing your client at the time?
Let's go right to that argument and the statute that they cite. Statute 481.08, an attorney may bind a client at any stage of an action or proceeding by agreement made in open court or in the presence of the court administrator. We don't have that anywhere in the record here either. There was no binding.
But what if we think about it in terms of agency principles? I mean, the attorney is the agent of the client, and the client has authorized the attorney to act on behalf of the client. And when the attorney represents that the client is accepting the settlement agreement, why isn't that a binding contract?
The statute specifically contemplates a signature of the parties. The statute is very specific.
Well, now we're talking about a signature of the agent, the duly authorized agent of the party, which is the same as the party when we're talking about agency.
There's no evidence in the record of that.
Well, that's a matter of law. That's a matter of that's a legal principle.
I'm talking about a matter of fact and what the record is before the court. There's no signature of an attorney. To a mediated settlement agreement, and there's no signature of my client.
Why isn't the email signature a sufficient signature?
There's no signature on a mediated settlement agreement by an attorney or by my client. There's no mediated settlement agreement with a signature of an attorney or my client anywhere in the record here. It's not anywhere.
When the email sets forth the terms of the agreement and there's a signature of the attorney on the email, why isn't that the equivalent of a settlement agreement?
There is no mediated settlement agreement with a signature on there. It doesn't exist. So it's fruitless to explore otherwise. There is no mediated settlement agreement on the four corners bearing a signature of an attorney, which wouldn't be any good anyways, because the statute here says it has to be an open court or before the court administrator. And there's no signature of my client, Mr. Olson, anywhere. There's a chain of emails going back and forth. There is no meeting of the minds. There is no signature on the four corners of a mediated settlement agreement.
Wait a second. There's certainly a difference between there's no signature and there's no meeting of the minds.
There's no signature. I don't even need to have a meeting of the minds. There's no signature. There's no signature on any mediated settlement agreement anywhere in the record in this case. It does not exist. And the statute specifically says it has to be signed and dated by the parties.
That requirement be waived?
Sure, it could be waived if you did it probably in open court.
Why does the waiver have to happen in open court? Why can't it be waived by the knowing consent of the parties?
There's no evidence of any consent of the parties.
There's an email. I mean,
yeah, the email. That's my, yeah.
Waived by, no, it there's this.
Is there a genuine issue of material fact? That's the question. Was there a genuine issue of material fact that your client did not agree to this, did not agree?
Yes, he does. His signature is not anywhere on anything here. The signature of his lawyer is not on any mediated settlement agreement. And this is.
Since you concede that it can be waived and the issue wasn't raised in the district court, you concede that, well, I assume you, did you not just concede that it could be waived or not?
No, I don't concede that. And it's speculative in this case.
Let's assume as a matter of law that the signature can be waived. And therefore, a party has to raise the issue in the district court as to the lack of a signature making the agreement infirm. What will we do then?
What is the question?
The question is one I just asked.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes. What would we do if the legal, if waiver is a legal issue, if waiver can exist, and your client didn't raise the question of the signature in the district court. The district court, if assuming that your client can waive the signature requirement, and your client didn't raise the argument that you're raising now in the district court, what remains of your argument to us?
We would have to see some evidence of a waiver. There's no evidence of waiver of a signature requirement anywhere in the record here.
Why would there have to be evidence of a waiver? Why can't the district court assume, since your client didn't make the argument, that the signature issue was waived? Can't you waive by silence? Can't you tacitly waive an issue? That's usually how it works.
I would think you would have to have a note. If you're confessing to $100,000, I would think you would have to have a knowing and intelligent waiver of this. This counsel below didn't do a very good job of this, but even so, the district court should have been on watch to say, let's take a look at what the statute says and let's apply the explicit terms of the statute. If it isn't there, you need to go back and say, let's comply with the statute or say, I need to see some indication of a knowing and intelligent waiver of the signature requirement in the district court.
I think that's a great argument if it had been raised in the district court. If I'm a district court judge and the parties are arguing over the validity of an agreement and no one's raising the signature issue, I'm why wouldn't the district court assume that the that issue is forfeited or waived, that there is no objection to there not being a signature? If you don't object to the district court, is the district court supposed to step in and make the objection for your client?
Yeah, they are. If lawyers aren't doing a very good job and they're not applying the statute, that's what needs to happen. It's no different.
So if you could cite the case for that, I would really appreciate it. I mean, there's no case cited in your brief. You keep telling us what you think and what you've done from your experience and what you believe from your experience. But is there any case law to support any element of your argument?
Well, this court has an unpublished case that I cited in my brief.
Right, an unpublished case is not precedent. So going back to my question, what is the case law that supports your proposition that the district court should step in when your client hasn't made an objection to the lack of a signature and make that objection on behalf of your client? What is the case that comes closest to that proposition?
I don't have a case on that. These are just general principles of being a district court judge. You don't find somebody guilty if you don't have a factual basis. You don't abrogate people's rights under statutes just because somebody doesn't raise it. The district court has an independent duty to make sure that the laws are being applied as they're written. You can't just abrogate statutes. There's a reason why statutes are written this way, and they need to be independently applied. Looks like my time is up.
So Mr. Hansen, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks.
Counsel?
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Rob Shanis. I represent Mark Lang. Your Honors, the appellant is asking this court to reverse the district court's enforcement of a settlement agreement based on a statutory argument that he didn't raise below, that lacks evidentiary support, and that was waived. Your Honors, rather than go through a recitation of the facts, I'm going to go straight to the questions you raised with opposing counsel and try and address them. And I'm going to do so in reverse and start with the issue of waiver. Certainly the statute can be waived. We cited case law for the very proposition that a statutory right can be waived by the parties. The particular sensitivity in this instance, Your Honors, is that this was in May of 2020, peak COVID. Everyone was terrified. Everyone was staying at home. Mediations were being conducted by social distancing. The Minnesota Supreme Court was issuing guidance routinely about distancing. And that is the context within which the settlement agreement was formed. That's important to note because when you consider waiver, what you're considering is the intentional relinquishment of a known right, which has two elements. First, from the perspective of intent, the case law we've cited says intent can be inferred from conduct. And for knowledge, you can have actual or constructive knowledge. There's no question from the record before the court that the parties understood that they were reaching an agreement in the context of a Zoom mediation, and that at the conclusion of that mediation, the parties agreed that their attorneys would confirm the agreement by email. In fact, Mr. Olson's counsel responded to one of the emails first saying, I need to confer with my client, I'll get back to you. And then if I could
pause you there, didn't the parties also recognize that whatever they did during mediation would be reduced to a signed writing?
Absolutely. That was the intention. And we cite case law in our brief, Your Honor, to address that there are settlements that have been enforced where there was an intention to reduce the agreement to a further writing. And that does not preclude enforcement of a settlement under contract law where the email itself contains all of the key elements.
Right. Under contract law, but I think I know Mr. Hansen's making the contention that beyond contract law, here you've got a statute that overlays it that includes a signed dated document as part of the process.
That's true. And the statute, in terms of the statutory requirements, you would first have to decide, Your Honor, that the statute applies at all. And we contend it does not apply because the Civil Mediation Act would have required an evidentiary basis by Mr. Olson. In other words, not only, Your Honor, did he not respond by briefing the issue before the district court. And not only did he not respond by replying to our brief here, but he did not submit before the district court the very evidence he would have needed to make this argument, which is that there needed to be a mediation agreement with a mediator. That is a prerequisite to considering it a mediated settlement agreement under the Civil Mediation Act.
So can I ask about that? When I look at the record, the settlement agreement towards the end of it says that the agreement to mediate is incorporated by reference. Isn't that enough?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. You cannot assume for the purposes of the record before this court that there existed a mediation agreement that contains the statutory elements of a mediation agreement, including that it be signed by the parties, that it be dated, that it set forth what the conflict is between the parties. And it may be technical, Your Honor, for me to point out that that doesn't exist in the record, but we're living in a world here where it doesn't seem to matter what is and is not in the record from the perspective of appellant. And so I think it does matter that this evidence that was appellant's obligation to marshal was not marshaled by appellant and is not in the record. And so there's no basis before the court to conclude that this is a mediation and settlement governed by the Civil Mediation Act, as opposed to being governed by basic contract principles upon which any court would say this is a binding settlement. I think it's important to point out, Your Honor, that no one is arguing, not appellant, not us, not the district court, that this would not have been an enforceable settlement agreement but for the Civil Mediation Act. The sole argument being put forth, Your Honor, is that somehow the Civil Mediation Act changes things. Everyone seems to agree, or at least there's no contention otherwise, that the elements set forth in the email provide everything one needs to form a contract. There's no dispute that there was a meeting of the minds between the parties and that they agreed to the terms. It's confirmed in writing by their attorneys, which is recognized in multiple cases that we cited as a way to be bound. Your attorneys have every ability to bind you. And the record shows that the parties clearly consented to this. Mr. Olson's counsel went back to him and confirmed his agreement. The record shows that the only reason he is choosing not to agree is because he claims to have learned some information subsequent to being bound. So it's hugely problematic to come into court and say, gotcha, on appeal, I'm going to make an argument about the absence of a signature under a statute that I never addressed before the district court. There are evidentiary issues that raises, for instance, the existence or non-existence of a mediation agreement, whether or not there was a signature somewhere else that's not in the record. Those are questions that can't be answered because the issue wasn't raised. And so I agree with the tone of Judge Ross's questions, which are that, why are we here? Why is my client contending with briefing this issue for the first time before this court, and as opposed to having been afforded the opportunity to address it with the district court below? Why, as an error reviewing court, are you in the position of having to determine whether the district court made an error when it couldn't have possibly made an error because it didn't have the opportunity to address this issue? That's the problem. That's the reason why there's ample case law that supports the proposition that we don't do this. We don't make arguments for the very first time on appeal and ask this court to deal with those. And we don't rely on the district court to make our objections for us and to make all the arguments that we might have made. But the issue of waiver, I think, is an important one, because I don't think it's merely, as Judge Ross suggests, the fact that the argument wasn't raised that there should have been a signature to constitute the waiver. I think it goes beyond that. The fact that the signature requirement was waived is evident in the emails between the parties, counsel. And of course, counsel can waive something on behalf of their client as much as they can settle on behalf of their clients. It's clear from the context of the emails that everyone understood that they were binding themselves to an agreement prior to a formal signature.
Well, just that, so we're clear, your client was the one who sent the draft agreement over to respondent, correct?
That's right.
And there was and there's a signature line in that agreement, in that proposal.
Absolutely.
So I think that that fact may run a bit counter to your position that everyone agreed that there would be no, that there, that it was basically an agreement that you wouldn't have signatures. It seems to, your draft would seem to indicate that everyone expected there to have been a writing that was signed by the parties.
Yes, Your Honor. And I know that there's, and I'm not grabbing it at the moment, but there's a specific case cited in our brief that addresses that fact pattern and provides that a settlement agreement can be binding even where the parties intended to enter into a subsequent writing memorializing it. The reality, though, on the facts, as the law is correctly applied, is that if you take the emails on their own and the attorney's correspondence, that in and of itself is sufficient to be binding. And the fact that they intended to memorialize it was simply because they're, it's customary to do so. And there would have been a stipulation for dismissal as well. The whole function, the way the mediation concluded, is I turned to the mediator, and this is in the record, and I said, I think it's important, given that we can't sign something today, that we memorialize the agreement. Would you please send an email to both counsel? And that's what the mediator did, and he set forth the terms. And both counsel responded saying, yes, that's what our clients agreed to. And an attorney can absolutely bind their client, and that's exactly how it's done. And everyone knew that that was the function of the email. There was no gotcha. You know, both counsel understood, and it was made clear that, by the mediator, that this is the reason. So I don't, I think that there is a waiver of the signature requirement from that standpoint, although I do agree, Judge Ross, that there was an intention to get, to button things up in a way by getting the parties to sign. I don't think that does anything to alter the larger issue here, which is that the entire argument has been waived as well. That is a threshold issue for the court to decide whether or not you even wish to entertain or should entertain the argument that the Civil Mediation Act applies. As I said before, there's no question that this is a sufficiently binding agreement that the district court did not err in the context of applying contract law. And then you have to address the question of whether the Civil Mediation Act applied. And the two responses to that are, it wasn't raised and it was waived because the parties, not only because it wasn't raised below, but also because there was no, it was understood by the conduct of the parties that they were binding themselves through their counsel. I don't believe I need to exhaust all my time unless Your Honors have additional questions.
Any other questions from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hansen, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir.
Just a couple things. Was there an agreement to mediate? Yes. That says agreement to mediate is incorporated by reference. The respondent can't have it both ways. Either there's an agreement to mediate and the Civil Mediation Act applies and therefore this statute applies requiring a signature of the parties and a date of the parties or not.
Just so we're clear, Mr. Hansen, when I was asking you earlier about whether you had raised the argument as to signature in the district court, am I also correct in understanding, I say you, your client, you were, I understand you didn't represent your client at the time. Am I also correct in understanding that your client never raised the Minnesota Civil Mediation Act, but that statute was never cited in the district court?
No, it wasn't cited, but that is the governing law here. And there's no waiver of that as the governing law. I mean, we can't get around the fact that no matter what, that's the governing law.
Just so we're clear, the district court was supposed to assume that the act applied and also assume that your client wasn't waiving the objection to the signature line, the signature requirement.
I don't think it's assumption. I think it's just part and parcel of what you do as a district court judge. You look to what the law is with each particular case that comes to you. You have a minor settlement agreement before you, you follow the statute for that. If you have a mediated settlement agreement before you, follow the statute for that.
Unless
it's waived, but there is no waiver here.
Unless there's no objection raised. I guess you keep going back to this idea that the district court had some duty sua sponte to assert your client's rights, and that your client had no obligation before the district court to present an issue, but could wait until appeal to raise an issue that wasn't raised in the district court. And you've had now, I mean, there was a 15-minute break when your opponent was arguing. Maybe you had an opportunity during that time to find a case that supports your proposition that the district court had some sua sponte duty to raise an objection that your client didn't raise.
Predecessor counsel did not do a very good job on this case. So I take this case as it comes to me. So I don't have a case on that. However, I simply go back to it's just axiomatic that the law is the law, and district courts need to apply what it is, and not waive it, no matter what the context of the case is, whether it be a minor settlement, whether it be a plea agreement, whether it be anything. You cannot go abrogating people's rights under the laws as they're written. And in this case, the Civil Mediation Act applies. You go to it, you take a look and say, well, have these elements been met? Have the requirements of this statute been satisfied? And if they have not, you say, well, you need to get a signature and come back and we'll have an agreement. And that's just the way things should be done. There is no indication. There is no signature on any mediated settlement agreement here. And I just ask that this court reverse and remand for further proceedings so we can have a trial on the merits of this matter.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted and we will issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.